This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, Shattered Glass, is based on the story of Stephen Glass, a staff writer for the New Republic who was considered one of journalism's rising young stars. He reported on light and serious stories that no one else was getting, including bad behavior at a conference of young conservatives and a clandestine meeting of anti-Clinton activists. It turned out there was a reason no one else had these stories. Some were partially fabricated, others were completely made up. 27 of his 41 stories for the New Republic contain fabrications. Shattered Glass tells the story of how Glass was uncovered in 1998 by a journalist at the online magazine Forbes Digital Tool and by Glass's editor at the New Republic, Charles Lane. A little later, we'll hear from Peter Sarsgaard, who portrays Lane in the movie. First, we'll talk with Lane himself. He now covers the Supreme Court for The Washington Post. Let's start with a scene from early in the film when Lane was still a reporter at the New Republic and the editor was Michael Kelly, played in the movie by Hank Azaria. The staff is at an editorial meeting. Reporters are pitching story ideas. Glass has a very amusing story.
Every station on the radio is talking about it. Mike Tyson biting Evander Holyfield. And these are supposed to be news stations. So on Tuesday, I started calling a few of them, and I finally got through to one, a Bible talk station in Kentucky. And I managed to convince the screener that I was a behavioral psychologist who specializes in human-on-human biting. I told the guy that I'd done all this extensive research on people who chomp flesh under extreme stress.
What did they say?
They put me on the air. I took calls for 45 minutes.
Oh, my God.
Why does he find these people?
It's kind of stupid. I know. It's silly. I'll probably just kill it.
Okay, moving right along. Chuck, what do you have for us?
Oh, it's a bit of a hard act to follow. Very hard act to follow. Okay. I'm starting the piece on Haiti. And I'm going to be going down to Port-au-Prince for a few days.
Uh-huh.
That's a scene from the new film, Shattered Glass. Charles Lane, welcome to Fresh Air. Was this an accurate representation of editorial pitch meetings? Did Stephen Glass sound kind of like that when he was making pitches, and were they as fantastic?
Yeah, I think so. I have to concede that this particular one that we just heard didn't quite take place. It's kind of a compression of a couple of different ones. But yeah, he had this kind of really engaging way of pitching these stories, and everybody looked forward to hearing what he would come up with next because they were always so colorful. It seemed like Steve had some kind of a gift or blessing that put him in the middle of a life that was much more interesting than everyone else's.
And did you feel the way I think you're described as feeling in the movie, that your story about Haiti seems so drab by comparison?
Not really. Like I say, that kind of immediate contrast never really occurred. In fact, that story about Haiti was assigned to me by Michael Kelly when he was still the editor. So I actually thought the Haiti story was kind of cool, but and involved a trip for 2 weeks to a Caribbean country and a lot of reporting. So I do think that what they're trying to get across in the movie is the sense that not just me, but a lot of other people on the staff were wondering, like, what's the value of our kind of regular mundane reporting when it seems that, you know, all these zany and colorful pieces that Steve Glass is coming up with are what really attract all the attention.
Did you ever think, these stories are too good to be true?
Well, I've thought about that so much looking back, 'cause for a large part of Steve's really his rise at the New Republic, I was actually not physically present at the New Republic, 'cause sort of from about September of 96 to about July of 97, I was away on a fellowship at Yale Law School. So I was more or less reading this stuff from a distance, you know? And a lot of them struck me, I remember, as thinking, like, this isn't really the kind of story the New Republic does, you know, because they seemed sort of, sometimes they were almost kind of crude. But I have to admit that, you know, seeing them one after another and knowing that there were editors and other people in the New Republic who were supposedly responsible for checking these, I didn't think that they could be completely fake. In fact, I didn't think they were even partially fake. You know, it's sort of that mystique that the words printed on paper acquire. And I took them, like everyone else, pretty much at face value, which now I have to say I'm really embarrassed by, that I wasn't the one really to find out right away.
Let me read one of the stories that Stephen Glass wrote that was published in the New Republic in February of 1998. It's called Plotters. When Hillary Clinton started ranting last week about a vast right-wing conspiracy, Beltway pundits could barely suppress their snickers. The First Lady seemed to be implying that somewhere in America there is a committee of middle-aged white men who regularly get together, hunch around a long oval table, and feverishly plot to undermine the Clinton administration. Does Mrs. Clinton really believe this malarkey? Does anyone? Actually, I do. Last Sunday, just such a meeting took place, and I was there. It was the monthly gathering of the Commission to Restore the Presidency to Greatness, or CRPG. And the scene unfolded exactly as the First Lady might have expected. The clandestine rendezvous took place in Northern Virginia at the rural home of software developer R. Theodore Curtis. The attendees were all middle-aged white men dressed in sober ties and starched dress shirts. Most had receding hairlines. Sitting on the table in front of each man was a name card listing his title and area of responsibility. Vice President for Vince Foster's Death Affairs. Special Counsel to Investigate Filegate. Deputy Inspector for Arkansas Issues. And so on. Was this story completely fabricated, Chuck Lane?
I think so. I think it was. And I'm trying to remember anything I can about how we edited it and fact-checked it. I'm just not really able to recall the process at that time. But yeah, that was a completely fabricated story. I mean, one thing, as I listen to you read it, it reminds me of are some of the elements of Steve's con, you know, that enabled it to go on for so long. One is the fact that the New Republic was an opinion magazine to begin with. So there, any story that was done in the magazine was allowed to have a certain voice and opinion. It's not a straight news publication. So that's one thing you can sort of see he's taking advantage of there. Secondly, he always seemed to be going to things that were happening in secret, you know, in basements among the members of a peculiar subculture, you know, so that it would be very hard for anyone to second guess him, anyone who assumed that he was a legitimate reporter, because you wouldn't really know yourself too much independently about this. And thirdly, and I think crucially, he works with stereotypes. You can see it in the middle-aged white man, you know, that he, and this is present in so many of his fake stories, and I think is really, to me, has been the really sobering lesson of this whole episode, was how the ability to put these stories over not only on editors but readers depended on the use of cliche and stereotype, knowing that in a way he was providing people with something not exactly that they wanted to hear, but that they were well prepared to hear. You know what I mean? And I think this story really illustrates that.
Do you think the story actually did real damage because it made up this like actual conspiracy, actual conspiracy against Clinton?
Well, this is what's so amazing about Steve's career, is that a lot of these stories were fake, but maybe could have been real. I mean, there is a group now, the Free Republic group, I think you've heard of them, which is, you know, sort of like the one Steve is talking about. Additionally, the Hack Heaven story, which was his last one, was about teenage hackers who were supposedly extorting money from the companies that they hacked into. And it turned out a couple years later, my own newspaper now, the Washington Post, did a story about Russian teenage hackers who had hacked into companies and were extorting money from them. They were caught, you know, by the FBI, and the story is true, and there are pictures and everything to prove it. But I'm just saying that in a way, Steve, in addition to all the other things I just described, he had a knack for finding things that were just crazy enough to be true.
My guest is journalist Charles Lane. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Charles Lane. He was the editor at the New Republic who uncovered the fabrications of reporter Stephen Glass. That story is told in the new movie, Shattered Glass. Let's talk about the story that you worked on that really uncovered Stephen Glass and his fabrications. This was a story called Hack Heaven. What was the story about?
Well, basically, it was about, it wasn't a very long story. It was about 1,300 words, and it described a young man of 15 years named Ian Restel, who was supposed to be a Russian immigrant who had learned how to hack into computers of big software companies, and he had hacked into one company's computer. The company was supposed to be called Juked Micronics, and posted all kinds of stuff on their website and then shaken them down for money so that he would stop, and that he supposedly had an agent and that he was part of a group of people who were doing this called the National Assembly of Hackers, and that this was becoming such a problem that states were considering legislation to stop it, and et cetera, et cetera. Again, you know, I have to... As I look back on it, it's the most perfectly ridiculous thing I've ever heard. On the other hand, you know, once it came across my desk after being across two other people's desks and in the rush of that week's business, I looked at it and I thought, okay, it's a pretty clever story and let's get it in the magazine. I'm really sorry about that. The only thing I'm not sorry about in a way is that this one was so outrageous that another news organization, Forbes Digital Tool, which was the website of Forbes magazine, wanted to somehow try and match this story because they felt they'd been scooped. And they went and started to look at it, and they called me when they couldn't find anything to back it up. And at that point, I thought, gee, you know, these guys really have made a good case that there's something wrong with this story, and I began to look into it myself.
Now, in the movie, when you get called by Forbes Digital Tool, your first reaction is to defend your writer, Stephen Glass. Did you feel that as an editor, that your first job was to defend him?
I actually felt very conflicted, because when Adam Pennenberg of Forbes called me and laid out in some detail what he had been unable to document in Steve's story, I immediately thought it could be a fabrication. At least I was open to that possibility. Whereas I think Adam and the people at Forbes were actually thinking maybe Steve himself had been duped by somebody. In any case, I called Martin Peretz, who was and still is the owner of the New Republic, and I told him what had happened. And I said, I'm going to look into this, and I want you to know that if it turns out that it was fabricated, we'll have to fire him.
At what point did you call him into your office and start questioning him about it? How much research did you want to do independently before calling him in? And how much did you want to just call him in first before you did any research?
Well, I brought him in right away. Mm-hmm. As I remember it, he wasn't at the New Republic, you know, physically when this happened.
Uh-huh.
But I called him in right away, and I think he came in from home. And his reaction was very strange, because the first thing he said was, what did I do? You know, did I do something wrong? And I said to him, well, you need to get all the phone numbers. I explained to him what Forbes was doing, and I said, you need to bring me all the phone numbers and information for how to contact all these people in the story. And what he came back with was a bunch of phone numbers. He would kind of gradually get one after another that turned out to be voicemails for the people who ostensibly existed, you know, these people in his story. And as that evening went on and I called these voicemails and didn't get anyone calling me back, and the voicemails themselves had very strange voices on them and that sort of thing, I began to realize this was very fishy. And it was my wife who pointed out to me, by going through the Yellow Pages, that there are these services that you can call that will allow you to set up a voicemail anywhere in the country under almost any area code, you know. And it was clear that he had just faked these voicemail boxes. But I realized that this is the kind of charge. If you're gonna be suspecting somebody of fabricating, you have to prove it. You know, you can't just level that charge without proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That was the way I approached it, because it's such a serious charge, and there's a presumption of innocence, right? So he then arranged to have his brother, unbeknownst to me, call me and represent himself as one of the people in this story. And when I heard an actual human voice purporting to be one of Steve's sources, I thought, wow, you know, there's reasonable doubt. Because, hey, here's sort of an actual person who seems to be real. And it wasn't until I discovered later that that person was his brother that all my reasonable doubt disappeared.
How did you figure that out?
Serendipitously, because late at night on the Friday, this all started on a Thursday afternoon, another editor of the magazine and I were talking about the situation on the phone, and she just kind of casually mentioned that Steve had a brother who lived in Palo Alto. And this is depicted in the movie. The phone number that he had given me for this software company was a Palo Alto phone number. And the voice I had heard on the phone had sounded oddly similar to Steve's. So I put two and two together. And the next morning, I went into the New Republic, and Steve was there, apparently trying to, you know, get rid of some evidence that was in his computer. And I confronted him about it. And at first he denied that it was his brother. And then, again, as depicted in the movie, he fessed up. Yes, I had my brother pretend to be this person. And I did it because even though that person is real, I couldn't find him and I needed to buy some time, which was obviously not true. And that was the end of his career.
Did he try to play you? Did he try to manipulate you?
Absolutely. Every step of the way. And he tried everything. You know, that Thursday night, I repeat, it all began on a Thursday. He called me at home late at night, and he became kind of aggressive. He said, you know, Chuck, you're not backing me up. You're making me feel very attacked. You know, an editor is supposed to back people up. And he was trying to throw me on the defensive. And what I remember saying to him was, you know, Steve, I want to back you up, but I don't have enough to work with right now. You have to give me more to work with. And what that illustrates is that at every point I was trying to remain even-handed with him, at least never tip my hand about where I was heading with this and never become emotional, because I think he would have tried, I even somehow intuitively sensed then that he would try to exploit that. The next day when, you know, I took him out to that hotel and made him walk around the site of this alleged event, which also helped prove that it hadn't happened. And then we get into the car on the way back and he broke down and he said, okay, I made up the conference and all the events in the story are real, but I made up the fact that I was there. I heard about it later and I made it seem in the article I was there. And then he said, but if you want me to say that I made the whole article up, I'll do that if it'll help you. And I saw that as a trap, you know, that he was going to try and make and do that and then say later that I'd coerced him into saying something that wasn't true. So I responded to him, no, Steve, I just want you to tell me what the truth is, you know. So he was at every moment, every step of the way, fighting to preserve his position at the magazine or whatever, to preserve his whole career. And he didn't hesitate to manipulate and lie.
Once you figured out, okay, this piece was a total fabrication, and a lot of other pieces were completely or partially fabricated as well, how did you figure out how to handle it? How to handle it with Glass was complicated but easy in the sense that you fire him. I mean, it's hard to do,
right.
But you do it, you fire him. But how to discuss this to the public, to your readers, to the rest of the press, that's really, really hard. So what was your thought process like about how to reveal this information to the public?
Well, one thing I was had as like a bottom line principle was there would be no cover up, right? That we would never find out anything about this case from anybody else through the press. So I wanted us to break the whole story before anyone else. And my first step in that regard was on Sunday, May the 10th, I called up Howie Kurtz of the Washington Post, who covers the media, and I just laid out to him what we knew at that point and that we were firing Steve Glass so that that would be out in the media before the Forbes story came out. That was step one. Then the follow-on step to that was we have to find out everything he did. You know, we have to completely investigate all of his stories and any other conduct, you know, that we might have to answer for and get that into the magazine as soon as possible. And furthermore, announce an apology for all of this and announce that we're going to investigate. So we did all that on Monday and Tuesday. And I thought one of the things that was good about that was that I involved the whole staff in this investigation of Steve's material. And I always felt that that gave some people something to do with their emotions at that time. You know, that everybody was feeling so lousy and so angry and everything else this gave people something to channel that into, and we all kind of worked together on it. There is a part of all that, dealing with the media, though, that I sort of regret in hindsight. You know, I was so kind of worried about how we would be treated and didn't for a minute expect that people would actually appreciate the fact that we were doing this full disclosure, that I became initially somewhat defensive with some reporters who approached me. And in a couple of cases, I kind of just turned them away and said, I don't want to talk to you. And that was a real mistake, you know, and I think it was just a mistake I made at the beginning that I, even now, I sort of regret. And that's one reason ever since, when I realized how bad it was not to be fully open with some people while being open with others, that I've always done interviews about this, because I just don't want, even now, I don't want anybody to say that, you know, there's some reluctance to discuss this.
Charles Lane is the editor at the New Republic who revealed the fabrications of the magazine's staff writer, Stephen Glass. The movie Shattered Glass is based on their story. Lane will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Charles Lane, the editor at the New Republic, who investigated a story by the staff writer Stephen Glass and found that Glass had fabricated the entire story. After Lane initiated a further evaluation of Glass's writing, the New Republic discovered that 27 of Glass's 41 pieces for the magazine contained fabrications. The new movie Shattered Glass tells the story of how Glass's lies were discovered. Charles Lane now covers the Supreme Court for The Washington Post. In June of 1998, the New Republic published a letter to its readers apologizing for the Stephen Glass fabrications and trying to explain as best as you could what happened. So I thought I'd read a short excerpt of that letter. How could this happen? It's a perfectly fair question. We've been asked it repeatedly since we informed the press of Glass's firing, and we expect to be confronted with it again and again. We are asking it of ourselves. The editors of the New Republic, like those of other magazines, have devised fact-checking procedures to ensure the accuracy of our copy. Generally, we believe our record in this regard has been a good one. Plainly, however, the precautions we took were not adequate to prevent Glass's fabrications from making it into print. We intend to find out why and to take corrective action where necessary. We editors take responsibility for the failures of discernment that permitted this false material to be published, but it is important to understand that our editing and fact-checking systems are designed to defend against the errors and mistakes even good professionals sometimes make, not against the systematic and intentional deceptions of someone who actually has no business practicing journalism. So that's an interesting distinction you make there, that fact-checking is for good journalists who kind of make a mistake, not for people who are intentionally liars and who are trying to manipulate the system.
Yeah, it's not fraud checking, as some people have said. And Steve really went to great lengths to deceive fact checkers, as has been noted before. You know, he made up false notes. He staged false voicemails, I later found out. He would occasionally invent documents. And so, you know, it was a pretty wide-ranging effort at deception. You know, I think one of the procedural things that was going on at the New Republic that made Steve possible was that he just happened to come along at a time when there was a lot of internal turmoil and transition among the editors of the New Republic. It was not a good time organizationally for the magazine. So he came on, I think, in late 95, and Andrew Sullivan was the editor. Andrew left the magazine and suddenly, you know, in the middle of 1996. And Michael Kelly was hired to replace him. But Mike, because he was under contract to The New Yorker, didn't come for about 6 months. So between about the middle of 96 and the end of 96, there was no editor of The New Republic. There was a series of sort of substitutes. And that was when Steve started writing more pieces. Then Mike Kelly came in. He only lasted for about 9 months. And, of course, Steve really began to really take off in that 9 months. And then I came in, you know, and with each new editor, there would be new fact checkers and new kind of subordinate editors. And there was a tremendous amount of turnover. And therefore, hard for any one person to kind of track Steve Glass through that. And I think he really exploited that kind of vacuum of authority. In addition, you know, the New Republic had had problems prior to this with another journalist called Ruth Shalit, who had plagiarized some material and had been suspended and, you know, really created kind of a black mark on the magazine. And I think a lot of the editors were focused on making sure, you know, that Ruth Shalit was performing up to snuff. And, you know, that kind of distracted attention from what anybody else, including Steve, might be doing. So it's very unfortunate, you know, that this, I think, reflects also that it was kind of a just a rough and tumble and uncertain and disorganized time at the New Republic generally, which kind of, I think, unbeknownst to anyone, created a climate that Steve could exploit.
Did you make any changes in the fact-checking system after the Stephen Glass story?
Yes. We developed a whole new written policy. We sort of cracked down on the use of unnamed sources and a lot of other things. But I have to say two things about that. Fact-checking at the New Republic is never going to be like fact-checking at a place like The New Yorker or Newsweek that are sort of like really big organizations with a lot of resources and large staffs. And The New Republic is a very small, low-budget magazine that never, I think, has ever had more than three people fact-checking, say, 20 stories a week. That's just a reality. And so there are going to be limits on it. And even, I believe very firmly that even the most sophisticated fact-checking system would be hard-pressed to stop certain kinds of journalistic fraud. The New York Times Magazine, which is an outstanding magazine with great fact-checking, has recently had to disavow the reporting of one of its people who had created a false composite character in a story. So there is no procedural fix, Terry, to the problem of a fraudulent journalist, because if somebody, for whatever purpose, is intent on doing it, they'll figure out the fact-checking system and find where its holes are and then try to exploit the holes.
Well, Stephen Glass was a fact-checker for a brief time at The New Yorker, so he knew the system.
Well, at The New Republic,
at The New Republic. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, Steve had been a fact-checker and was known as a very thorough and rigorous one, which was all part of his scam, you know, because another reason people didn't suspect his own work was that he ostensibly was so concerned about facts. He was entrusted with that responsibility, quite mistakenly, of course.
If there were warning signs about Stephen Glass before he was actually uncovered, what were those signs?
Well, a number of times people wrote letters to the editor, not while I was editor that I recall, but prior to that, a number of letters to the editor were written where people said, this just didn't happen, it's not true. And, I think that was looked into, and Steve, you know, came up with a lie that seemed to account for it, and, you know, people moved on. So that's very unfortunate. But again, I go back to this. It's very hard to make this charge, Terry. It's very hard to go to somebody and say, you know what? I think you might have fabricated. Prove to me that you didn't. Because it's such a serious charge, you know. It's like accusing a priest of, violating his vows of whatever, poverty and obedience. It goes so to the heart of the profession that unless you feel very strongly you have the evidence, you don't initially make it.
Are there specific examples of how the fact-checking process has been changed?
Well, you have to remember, I haven't been there since 1999, so I don't know what they're doing right now. But right. I can comment on what happened when I was there.
Sure.
And absolutely, you know, I can remember specific cases where, for example, we got a report from a freelancer in Kosovo, I think. And that person was telling us that such and such a person didn't want her name used. A person in Kosovo, right? And therefore couldn't be quoted by name. But we insisted that she give us a name and address, I believe, for that person in Kosovo before we would use the unnamed quote, so that we would have some, even though we wouldn't use the person's name, we would know what it was. And that was pursuant to a policy we developed that whenever you use an unnamed quote, you would have to supply the name to at least one editor so that there'd be some other person who would know that the person was real. And we took a lot of precautions like that. And frankly, we challenged a number of people who weren't too happy to be challenged, but we felt we had to do it, you know.
Have you seen Stephen Glass again since firing him?
The only time I saw Steve was a brief glimpse of him across a room when I went for a visit to his lawyer when I was still editor of the New Republic, and I haven't seen him since.
He's writing again. How do you feel about that?
Well, I didn't appreciate his book, his novel, which I felt really kind of contradicted his expressions of remorse, because the book portrays not only me but other people who were responsible for unmasking him in a very, very negative light. Obviously, it's a roman à clef. We're not named, but we're also not fools, and we know what's based, you know, who these characters are based on. And so I was troubled when I read it, because he has been now going public and saying how much remorse he feels and sending out letters of apology and that sort of thing. But the book, I think, once again shows the kind of nasty side of Stephen Glass, and shows that he seems to have this need, when he's fictionalizing, to create people who are to be made fun of or are to be viewed in a negative light.
He's writing journalism again, too, isn't he? I think he's writing for the Rolling Stone again.
I think he wrote one article for them, yeah. And, well, you know, caveat emptor.
Charles Lane is the editor at The New Republic, who revealed the fabrications of the magazine staff writer Stephen Glass. Lane now covers the Supreme Court for The Washington Post. The movie Shattered Glass is based on the story of Stephen Glass.